All right, and now, how did you like lunch? Was it wonderful? That pickled daikon, nice. Wasn't that good? That's the fermented foods that we're talking about. So everything that Dr. Tom talked about, you got to eat today. If you were able to, you could choose all the little different things, and you could just feed your microbiome. So you are well on your way already to combating autoimmune disease and to healing. Yeah, isn't that exciting? Okay, and speaking of exciting, we're ready to give it up for Dr. Rita Marie. Let's have a big round of applause. Yay!
Woo! Oh, woo! Where is everybody? They didn't come back for the raffle, and they're not here yet. Is everybody still at lunch? I bet it's the ones that didn't do VIP, and they're waiting in line for lunch somewhere. I bet that's it. All right, how's everybody doing? You enjoyed the lunch? Yes? You enjoying the prizes? Yes? All right. So this afternoon, we're going to go into a little more. That was this morning, so let's go ahead. And you can set my timer, too. That was HeartMath. That was Dr. Tom. And here we are. So this afternoon, I really wanted to talk about food principles. You heard Dr. O'Brien talk a lot about various things and the probiotic things, the fermented foods, and all this kind of stuff, and that our autoimmune situation is really at epidemic proportion, and people are suffering when they don't need to be suffering, okay? So what I wanted to do this afternoon is talk about what I call the food religions. Has anybody ever experienced it that way? Somebody has their diet dogma, their diet religion, and you've got to follow this, and it's like it's a one-size-fits-all. Does anybody think that we can do diet as a one-size-fits-all? No. Do we have clothes that are one-size-fits? You know how they fit if they're one-size-fits-all. You're either walking around with this thing that's killing you, or you're in the sack, right? There's no one-size-fits-all. So there's no one-size-fits-all diet. And a lot of the stuff Dr. O'Brien talked about this morning work beautifully, like eating lots of vegetables. But sometimes you're going to have somebody that comes in and says, when I eat a lot of vegetables, I get sick. Has anybody ever heard that before? Right? I start to drink green smoothies, and it's lots of vegetables packed in, and it's great, but I don't feel well. I feel worse. Does that mean the vegetables are bad? No. It means that they're not processing it. Does that mean they have to give those vegetables up for the rest of their life? No. Right? So we want to look at how can we adapt a diet that will support the person where they are and then evolve to where they're heading. Does that make sense? So that's what we're going to talk about this afternoon. We clearly know it's not this food pyramid, right? It's a disaster. Louisa Light. She came up with, she was called upon and paid as a nutritionist to help put this together, to help put this pyramid together for the FDA. And they said, look, we need this. And she came up with something that was totally not this. But the food companies shut her down on it. They lobbied, they paid a lot of money and said, no, we can't make money on like tons of fruits and vegetables. So they created this. What is at the bottom? Breads and cookies and crackers. They say whole grains as much as possible, but that's BS, right? People see that and they go, oh, I just have to eat crackers and bread all day. And we know that that's not good. And we know that for some people, it's a disaster. So if not this, then what? Well, it's kind of personalized, and that's where we come in, right? I could say, well, here's a more rational approach, making sure people get enough water because most people don't drink water. They're drinking soft drinks and coffee and tea and alcohol as their liquid and thinking they're getting hydration. But look at the base is those green leafy vegetables. There's some fruits in there. But the point is that some people at the point they're at don't tolerate a lot of fruit, because they've got blood sugar issues that need to be addressed, or because they have some out of balance growth in their gut that needs to be addressed, and it's just going to feed it. Perfectly good food can feed the bacteria. Perfectly good food like fruits is not going to cause a health problem. It's not going to cause somebody to be diabetic. It's all the other stuff that they are eating that makes them not tolerate those good foods, those fruits, those sulfur-containing foods some people don't tolerate. So this afternoon, I want to look at how do we come up with food plans that work for the individual where they are, with the idea of being able to evolve them to where they really want to be. We do not want those food plans to become food dogma. Good food, bad food. You have to eat this all the time. You can't eat this all the time. When it gets past dogma, we get into its religion, and then people fight over it. Do you ever see those food wars on the internet? Like, this person says one thing and then they rebut it, and they're battling back and forth as to who's right. The truth is, and Gandhi said this once, every religion has a piece of the truth. Every food religion has a piece of the truth. And I won't count the standard American diet as a food religion. It ain't happening, and it doesn't really have any truth to it. Okay? But this is what we want to really avoid, is that it becomes food cult. And then it's what? When religion turns to cult, it goes from supportive to dangerous, right? We're follow the leader blindly no matter what they say. And that's what we want to avoid. And a lot of people are getting into that now. And they see it as dangerous. They're eliminating huge quantities of foods, and they're doing it for long periods of time, and they're creating deficiencies. And we want to avoid that. I've had people come, who's heard of a FODMAP diet? Great. Who's never heard of a FODMAP diet? Good. So I don't have to explain. So people will come in and they'll go, I've been on this FODMAP diet for 3 years now, and it's not helping. No, it's not helping. Why? Because it's not intended as a 3-year diet. Or I've been on a keto diet for 4 years, and now I'm having these weird things happening. It's not intended. It's a therapeutic diet. A FODMAP, low FODMAP diet, is a therapeutic diet that you then transition from into a more wide range. But it's because the gut is out of balance. It's leaky. There's dysbiosis. The microbiome is messed up, that we don't get the results. So we want to avoid that. These are some of the food religions, because they can be that, right? You talk to somebody who's macrobiotic, thinks the person who is, you know, eating paleo is like a creature from outer space and should be shot, right? And somebody who's paleo, they start to badmouth people who are plant-based and vegan. There's room for it all, okay? And I know that in the talk that Dr. O'Brien just did, he talked about bone broth and collagen, not collagen, colostrum, and fish oils. My take is you can be vegan and get the benefits of foods that have those properties. So for those of you who are plant-based, don't start freaking out like, oh my God. No, you can do that. I do it. I've been doing it for 35 years. The point is that we have to look at what is it, what is the constituent? Fish oil is not a nutrient. Omega-3 fats are nutrients, right? So we look at where we get that from. Okay, you look at bone broth, okay? Lead. Lead accumulates in bones and even in organic bones, because you can't control this. You can control the soil in organic farming. You can't control the environment. And lead is in the environment and gets absorbed. So there are studies that show that there is too much lead in bone broth to be helpful if you're doing a lot of it. So you got to be careful and look at that and say, okay, can I get those nutrients elsewhere? The gelatin he talked about, no, but what is it? If that gelatin is what's coating the gut and that's what's creating the issue, the helpfulness, then yeah, you need that. But what else can you get that's similar to that? That's a mucilaginous component that heals. And there might be cases, if you are a strict vegan, that in order to get your health back, maybe you temporarily have to include colostrum or bone broth or other things like that. I'm totally open to that. But I think what I get is a lot of people are plant-based eaters and they're going, but they're trying to get me to eat this. I don't want to eat it. Okay, you don't have to necessarily. Let's see where it goes. I'm not going to choose. This is where it gets dangerous, right? If they're choosing to be vegan from an ethical standpoint, but at the risk of something they can't get elsewhere because of their metabolism or whatever, that can be dangerous. Right? And it's a matter of being an astute practitioner to be able to help them determine that. I've been 100% plant-based for 30 some years, 35, almost 35 years, right? And I still make good protein. I still have good musculature. I'm very healthy. But other people don't get all that they need, and their health starts to deteriorate, but it's blamed on being plant-based or vegan. When in fact, it's other things that are going on that are causing them not to be able to process the nutrients from that food. So I'm not giving dogma about one way or the other. I know what works for me. And I know that there are clients of mine who don't do well on all vegetable matter. So you're going to have to work with them and put your own dogma aside. I would love it if everybody thrived on just vegan food. But because of sometimes it's the mental, sometimes it's the cultural, sometimes it's biochemical, sometimes it's genetic, maybe they don't. But it's a matter of helping a person where they're at and not saying, this is my dogma, here you go, apply it to you. And I've had a lot of people, I know some of the practitioners in our programs have said that they've been told that they absolutely will never get healthy. You can't be healthy on a vegan diet, okay? So other people who are vegan will say, oh, you can't be healthy if you eat any animals. I don't believe that. You know, a lot of people have a huge quantity of vegetables in their diet, the right amount, and they have organically raised, pastured, small amounts of animal products. They do fine. They do fine. It's just a matter of really us tuning in and not making it about religion, not making it about our own ethical stand on it, but making it about what's best for that person. Does that make sense? Does everybody agree with that? Yes? Okay, so these are some of them. We're not going to go into every one of these. We have a module in our NEPT program that's probably about 20 hours long because we take each of these. We go into major detail about how do you know who it's right for, how do you know when to do it, how do you do it, and we have them on all of the things I'm going to talk about today. I have an hour and a half today rather than 20 hours, so I'm condensing it down to some of the tidbits and the nuggets you need to have. And I'll go fast through stuff if you already know it. I'll check in. But the stuff that you don't, some of these obscure, you've all heard of these. We're not going to go into details on these. The ones I'm going to go into in detail are these. Whoops. The ones that are based on the chemicals constituents, right? So FODMAPs, you've heard of. SCD, GAPs. Who's heard of that? Nightshade avoidance, right? Does anybody really like get the details of why that's important? Oxalates, phenols, salicylates, histamines, and other amines, sulfur, and lectins. Okay, we're going to look at those, just a little overview, so you have enough nuggets. You have the copies of all these slides, so I'm not going to go through every detail of every slide that I go through. I want to get you the big picture, and then you can dig in and you can learn more. Is that fair? Okay, because I would have had to just pick one of them if I wanted to really do it thoroughly in that, oh man, this thing is like trippy. Okay, so what do we need to take into account to be able to create the best meal plan? Want to throw some things out for somebody? It's all up there. I forgot I did that. Age, genetics, their past history. Do they have a history of a bowel resection? And they only have this much of their bowel left. Are they missing part of their small intestine? Have they had, you know, a lung removed? Have they had a kidney removed? Right? We need to know that past history, and we need to be able to ask the questions to get there. We have a whole module that we teach every single question that you should be asking to get to the heart of what really is going on. Because we can say, oh, you have this symptom. Oh, I need to put you on a gluten-free diet and give you glutamine. Or we can really dig to find out, what did Tom say? Why? Right? Why? The next piece of this, I have a whole exercise for you. On why. So, and we didn't even plan that together, so it's really perfect. So the age, the genetics, their past history, their digestive status. Steph's going to do a whole talk next on the digestion and the microbiome and how can you help to optimize the microbiome for individual people. How can you choose the right probiotic prescription? It's not just any off the shelf. How do you know? And there's no protocol. So Dr. Tom showed up a protocol for leaky gut healing, but it's not going to be exactly the same. That's a great framework. Protocols, in my mind, are frameworks. So we start with a framework. Oh, how do we get rid of H. pylori? Oh, we have masticum, and we have tumetulati, and we have, you know, whatever. You just give this list, but how do you customize that to the person? Oh, this person's sensitive to this, or this person can't tolerate that, and you've got to customize. So from my standpoint, when you understand the underlying biochemistry and physiology, and you understand some of the natural medicine tools and functional medicine assessments, that's when you're able to create those plans. Because you're not going by somebody else's written protocol and you don't really understand it. You're getting, well, what's happening when the food goes down and into the esophagus and then it goes into the stomach and then there's the gastroileal reflex and then there's the gastrin and then there's, you know, and on and on. Those of you in CMDS got what I'm talking about, right? Right? It's a complex process. There's a whole endocrinology associated with digestion. So if you understand that, you may not know the protocol for dealing with Crohn's disease. But knowing what Crohn's disease does, what's the pathophysiology, what's the physiology of the gut, you go, no, Crohn's disease, it is an inflammatory condition. Well, it's an inflammatory condition that occurs in this part of the body. Ah, it's considered autoimmune. Where are we going to start, right? We're going to heal the autoimmunity. So you know so much more than you think you know when you understand how it all works. And I've had lots of people come on our Facebook group and they'll say, oh, what should I do? I have a person who has, you know, myositis of sifficans. I'm like, okay, you got an itis in there, right? Look it up to see if it's autoimmune. Let's start there. Let's start with the foundations. Let's start with working with that. How else is it working? The difference between dealing with autoimmune conditions is where it's located. So if you have a thyroid autoimmune, you're going to have some specific things geared towards healing the thyroid, versus if you have lupus, which is dealing with connective tissue and other organs, versus if you have rheumatoid arthritis, which is dealing with the joints, those band-aids are always going to be different. Those temporary band-aids and the healing of that tissue is going to be different, but the process in the body is really pretty much the same. So when you can master that and understand how the body works, you're in great shape. So their nutrient status. We talked this morning about how you can look at their nutrient status. There's also lots of different lab tests that you can do for that. We're going to look at some of that tomorrow when we look at the specific nutrients for specific conditions. Hormone status, right? And who believes that the endocrine system is like this one little isolated system, kind of like the digestive system, or it's all over, right? You can't find a spot and say, here's where it exists. The digestive system, you can kind of do that, right? The urinary tract system, you can find, could do that. Where would you draw the circle around for the endocrine system? The whole body, right? So the endocrine system is everywhere. And so when somebody talks about hormones, generally, at least when I talk about hormones, I'm not talking about progesterone, estrogen, and testosterone. That's the limited world view of hormones. And then maybe thyroid hormone or adrenal hormone. We're talking a lot more than that. And I'll show you that. We'll go into hormones tomorrow. Oh, man. There we go. So this is really key. We look at that chart I had previously, and we had all those greens and fruits and whatever in there. Good stuff. But what about when healthy food hurts, right? What about when healthy food, somebody eats greens, they eat something high in sulfur like broccoli and they suddenly have joint pains or brain fog, right? What about when those foods hurt? That's when you need to understand the process, the whole process of what's going on. And there's lots of it, right? So people think, I'll eat whole grain bread because that's the healthy alternative, right? That's what mainstream America calls. They're eating gluten. They're eating a refined process, so the blood sugars are going up and the gluten receptors are getting activated. The leaky gut is getting activated. So when those good foods hurt. No, but then also there's like when broccoli hurts. Like you eat broccoli and you have a problem. People get gas or get bloated or they feel spacey. The sulfur in there might be a problem. Oxalates might be a problem. So we have to look at it. And we're going to give you a tool that you're going to love. It's not quite finished, so you're only getting one page of it, but it took about 10 times as long to make as we anticipated it. So we all know if we look at this, there's not a lot of redeeming value, right? These are foods that we all consider the bad stuff. If we look here, we might all be tempted to say, these are all good. And for the most part, they probably are good for most people, most of them. But some of them are not. So oxalate sensitivity, there's foods you have to leave out. Histamine sensitivity. It doesn't mean the foods are bad, and it doesn't mean it's a permanent restriction. It means you take away the damaging effect, right? You take away the stressor, and you heal, and then you gradually put things back in. So there's a process. Same way you might do for when you're suspicious that somebody's allergic to some foods. You take out those allergens, you help them heal their gut, and then you add them back. But if you take out the allergens, and you just keep eating all the stuff that's aggravating the leaky gut, and you don't heal it, then they start to take those, they develop new allergens, so you test them again, and now they've got 20 new things that they're sensitive to, right? Who's ever seen that with lab testing, or for yourself, right? And then you go back, and what's happening after that? Well, you start to add them back, and maybe the old foods don't work, but the new, it's a vicious cycle. You've got to heal that damage that these things have caused. So we're going to look at the basics that, I don't know if anybody disagrees with this list, then let me know, because these are the basics that everybody kind of agrees on, is that the food should be fresh, that it should be whole, we should have a lot of plants in there, it should be nutrient dense, right? Not like the junk food, which is calorie dense, nutrient deplete, organic, right? Having the essential fats included, because we can't make them, having the essential amino acids, because we can't make them either, and we'll go into details on that tomorrow, and free of preservatives, additives, and GMOs. Anybody have anything they disagree with on that, that would be the basics of a sound diet? But who's ever had the situation where you put somebody on a diet like that, or they come in to see you and they're already eating that way, and you're going, huh, they still don't feel good, right? They still don't feel good. Why? Well, it could be that there are particular things that they're sensitive to in that diet because they have a leaky gut, because their microbiome is off, etc. But it could also be that there's other components, right? Their stress level. They're eating perfect food, but they're like this all the time, and cortisol's raging through their system, shutting down their digestion, right? Or they're not getting enough sleep. Or they're not having fun in their life, and every day is this like, right? Environmentally, they're working in a factory where they're exposed to chemicals. At home, they're using pesticides. They're, you know, buying new carpeting and not, you know, letting it air out for 3 years before they move in, right? They have mold, right? Well, that's true, right? How soon after you get new carpeting in should you actually live in that house to be safe? Years, because of all the formaldehyde and all the chemicals that are in there, unless you buy organic cotton or wool carpeting, okay? So we're exposed, and we want to give them more than just a diet. So we're going to do an exercise, and we have a handout. And this is the power of why. So Dr. O'Brien talked about earlier, right? Why? So somebody comes in and says, I have hot flashes. And the brilliant doctor says, oh, well, let me test your hormones. Oh, your estrogen's out of balance. And the person says, why? They said, because you're 50. Okay, well, but you're not supposed to get hot flashes. It's supposed to transition naturally, and hot flashes are pathological. So, okay, why do we have the hot flashes? It's not because you're 50. It's because your hormones are fluctuating up and down. Well, why are your hormones fluctuating up and down? Why is your body not adapting there? Well, it could be that your thyroid's out of balance, because it's important to have good thyroid function to have that transition. Well, why is your thyroid out of balance? Because you have a deficiency of Synthroid, right? No, it's generally not that. It's because something's aggravating it. Stress aggravates it, environmental toxicity. So you just keep going backwards on the why. And maybe for that hot flashes, you get to that they have an out of balance microbiome. They're not digesting their food, but you still want to ask why. Right? They've been on antibiotics. They're on birth control pills. They're eating a crap diet. So it's always going back. And you're always safe when you start with those foundations we talked about before, what I call the body freedom foundations. When you start there, so regardless of how advanced you are in your training, you can get people a long way by just teaching them some of those foundations, right? Looking and asking the questions. And so you have a sheet in front of you. It says the power of why. Does everybody have that? Okay, so mine seems to have, there it is. All right. So the first thing, and we're going to do this for one symptom. So I want everybody to take out a pen, and on that paper, instead of listing all of it that you would, because they're going to come in with symptoms, they're all going to also going to come in with a diagnosis. My doctor says I have, right? And that's just another symptom in my book, right? Just because they were diagnosed doesn't mean they own that disease and it's a lifelong thing, but they're usually told, you have Crohn's disease. It's a lifetime thing. You're never going to get over it. And then they buy into it. Right? Don't they believe it? And they go, I can't do that because of my Crohn's. I can't do that because of my fibromyalgia. They don't own fibromyalgia or Crohn's. It's just a label that's put on a set of symptoms that they are presenting. So don't let your patients and clients own their diagnosis. Don't let them use their diagnosis as an excuse for not living life. You want to get to the heart of why. Because in medicine, it's a matter of taking the sets of symptoms, putting them in a box based on a set of symptoms, correct? And then applying a particular set of drugs or surgeries or procedures to that. We're more going to down to the root. So just list one. Just pick one. List that. And then ask why. Like, what are the possible reasons that could lead to that challenge? Just ask it at one level. Why? So, for example, the person comes in and they're complaining about their stomach hurts, doubled over pain every time they eat. So you're going, oh, what could be some of that thing? So right away your brain's going to go to, oh, maybe they have Crohn's. Maybe they have celiac. Maybe they have. So you're going to want to label that. And if that's where you go, fine, because you're going to take it to the next level. So why do they have that? And then the next level, why? So what I'm having you do on here is for each of their presenting symptoms and diagnosis, again, you're going to take one. You're going to ask why. Okay? So this person has, let's just say they present with hot flashes, right? And we say, why? Okay, estrogen imbalance. You'd write that here. Estrogen imbalance, right? Then you say, why does this person have an estrogen imbalance? What are some of the reasons they could have an estrogen imbalance? Depending on where you are in your studies and how much knowledge you have, you know about estrogen excretion and conversions and stuff. You go, oh, well, maybe they have a problem with their liver because the liver is what's supposed to break down the estrogens and get them eliminated, and maybe they have a buildup of these bad estrogens. Or maybe they are drinking out of plastic water bottles that are sitting in their car and they're getting all these hormone inhibitors and antagonists, and they've got that in their body, you know? Or maybe they are exposed to PCBs in other ways. They have the plastic shower curtain that they live with, and they have all kinds of other things that they're drinking out of or eating that contain these endocrine disruptors. So it's you get what I'm going through? It's just not taking it. Okay, estrogen imbalance. Why? Okay, why? Maybe it's a buildup of, maybe the liver is out of balance. Okay, why? Why would the liver be out of balance? Could it be the Diet Cokes that they're eating and the alcohol they're drinking, or drinking, both cases? Could it be the non-organic foods and they're getting a buildup of pesticides? Can it be that they live in an environment where they're breathing in all kinds of chemicals in the environment? Why? What's the reason? And you just keep going backwards until you get to a point where you feel like it's something you can sink your teeth into and give them something to do. Does this make sense? So the why is super, super important. And I would recommend that you take this back later and just really sit with somebody, whether it's your mom, yourself, a client that you're working with, a patient, and fill this in and see if you could just take that inquiry process backwards. Don't settle with, oh, because, you know, they're eating gluten. So the main diet categories I look at, there's animal-centered diets, there's plant-centered diets. And I call this the centered versus based versus exclusive, because animal-centered diets are mostly going to be animals, but people are going to be eating. So this would be like the Weston Price diet, for example. They really advocate lots and lots and lots of animal products, quality animal products, and less of that. This might be over here like a plant-based or like a vegan diet or a macrobiotic diet where they include mostly plants but a little bit of fish here and there. So, but we don't need to spend too much time on that because you're going to help your person create the right balance for them. So I'm going to talk about a couple of these that stand out for me in terms of these diets and what's included with them, and then we're going to go into the ones with the chemicals. So body ecology, who's heard of body ecology diet? Yeah? So body ecology diet, Donna Gates, it's an antifungal. It's basically to help clear up the gut of funguses and candidas and yeasts that are growing there. And it's basically it's like 80% plant-based, and it's 80% alkaline forming. She's in the 80-20 rule, right? So everything's 80%, but the other 20. So she'll include some organic chicken or beef or fish, but she's not going to have, you know, you're not going to go to McDonald's and get a hamburger even if you forego the bun if you're on body ecology, right? You're just going to, yeah. So the other thing is she's got some very strict rules about which grains you can eat just because of the possibility of fungal contamination. So that's a very strict diet. You've got the SCD and GAPS diet, which I'm going to show you in more detail, which are not, they're restricting not carbohydrates as a category like keto might, but they're restricting categories of carbohydrate. Oh man, this thing's driving me nuts. So then we have people who are espousing a high-carb, low-fat diet. And these are all healthy high-carb, low-fat diet, not the standard American diet, which is not. So Esselstyn, McDougall, Ornish, 80-10-10, Fruitarian, Engine 2 diet. These are all therapeutic diets that these particular practitioners have used and had amazing results with people. But it doesn't mean that everybody is going to thrive on an Esselstyn diet, which has absolutely no oil, almost no nuts or seeds, and it has a fair amount of grain, but lots of vegetables. But it's an extreme low-fat diet. And remember Dr. Tom was talking about the ApoE gene? The ApoE44s thrive on that diet because they can't handle the fats. Genetically, they can't handle the fats properly. So they thrive on that diet. But other people don't necessarily thrive on that diet. Somebody who has a lot of genetics towards insulin resistance may not thrive on that diet because it's got way too much grain. Does this make sense? So these are the kind of things you're going to keep in mind as people come in. Like, where are they going to loosely fit? And then how can you customize it? FODMAPs, fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. So that's eliminating all of these kinds of carbohydrate foods. Polyols are sugar alcohols. So when somebody goes on this diet, it's usually because they have a gut imbalance. It's very widely used for SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and also for IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. So these are the kind of things that are allowed. So, you know, you can just read this. I'm giving you this as a take home. But some of the things that are allowed are, you know, most fruits, most vegetables, no grains, no fructose-containing foods. So some of the fruits are off limits or in small amounts. It's not that you're going to eliminate all these because you can't. It's which foods have the most of them. And you basically follow this diet. But the thing is, it's a temporary diet. It's a healing diet. At last year's, was it Shine or SIV? I can't remember. Craig Summers did a talk on it was at our SIV conference in the spring. And he is basically came, a lot of stats and a lot of information about it, basically came down to, it's a therapeutic diet. You do it for a short period of time. Specific carbohydrate diet, again, we're limiting, whereas the FODMAPs is eliminating all those carbohydrates, specific carbohydrates is allowing monosaccharides, which could be things, sucrose, glucose. We'll go into the carbohydrate metabolism tomorrow so you understand that better. But the disaccharides are not allowed. So sucrose is a disaccharide, and sucrose is a disaccharide, but glucose and galactose are monosaccharides. So the monosaccharides are allowed here. So this diet will actually allow a little bit of dairy products, usually fermented, because they have galactose, which is from the lactose. And then there's the allowed foods and the avoid foods. So you'll have these lists as charts, but I'm going to show you something even more fun than that. I was very discouraged by those diets because people would come in following them, but not getting results even because there's a lot of crap on the standard thing, like bourbon. Really? That's not really good for somebody who has a liver problem, right? And then they had some artificially sweetened marmalade. I mean, come on, people shouldn't be eating that, right? So I went through and I made a version of it that we give, and you'll have this on your sheet. It's a SIBO diet that combines FODMAP and SCD, and that's what's been found to work well for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So I've created this, which is just the good stuff, and I leave the bad stuff out. Then we have gut and psychology, which came from the SCD, and it was converted and made to be more geared towards brain stuff, brain health. So that's the gut and psychology. And what they do is they include, in addition to the dietary, there's probiotics and there's the bone broth and other supplements that people will need to help the healing. And you've got all of these on, these will be on the page for you. They should be out there already. They actually are, right? They're already on there. So if you log in, does anybody, if you need that login, you're not sure, go and see one of the team members. Doreen over there, she can help you. So nightshades, who's ever gone off nightshades and felt better? Yeah? A lot of people don't tolerate the nightshades. Nightshades are these four foods, basically tomatoes, eggplant, potatoes, and peppers. And for some people who are sensitive to the chemicals in there, which are these, basically, the solanine, the nicotine, and the capsaicin, and you may be sensitive to one or more of these, but you feel better. You don't get the aggravation and the irritation, the immune response. And it usually is people who have an autoimmune condition that don't do very well with nightshades. So nightshades avoidance. So now we're looking, even we're only a few diets in, and we're thinking, what's left to eat? So I'm not saying that anybody should be following all of these. You got to determine which are the ones that they're going to need and then figure out what they could eat. Because when I finish here, if you were to try to follow all of these diets, and we're going to show you a chart that we put together, you're not going to see any of them have green all the way across. Like, there's no food other than water, right? So we can't do that. But people drive themselves crazy because they run from summit to summit, book to book, seminar to seminar, trying to get well. And they're going to try everything. Well, I'm on the low FODMAP diet, and I just added the low histamine diet, and next week I'm going to add low oxalates. And then they're like, what else can I eat? Ain't going to be nothing left. So you really have to go and ask why? It's a big question. So oxalates. Who's ever tried a low oxalate diet? Know what oxalates are. Okay. Any luck with it? Or frustration with it? Or didn't see a difference? Yeah. So sometimes the thing is, there may be multiple areas of sensitivity and we try one of them and we don't see a difference. And it could be that when you try just one of them, it really isn't a problem for you, right? So oxalates, they form crystals in the body. So oxalates bind to minerals, and generally they're not supposed to pass through the gut lining. So if you get oxalates in the blood where it's causing a whole bunch of symptoms all over, what's going to happen? They're going to deposit those crystals. Why are they in the blood? They shouldn't be. They should be binding to minerals and being excreted in the stool. So anybody that's having a systemic effect to oxalates, you want to ask what's going on in the gut that's creating it. And there are bacteria, oxalobacteria, that eat it, that eat the oxalates, right? If we have an out of balance biome, right, and we're just predominating in all these pathogenic bacteria, then we're not going to be able to eat up the oxalates because the oxalobacter have been squashed and stamped out. Does that make sense? Oxalobacter is not something you're going to buy as a probiotic. It's not on the shelf. It's not on the market. And this timer isn't on, so I have no clue how far in I am. All right, so oxalates, they bind minerals. So spinach, for example, is a high oxalate food. Spinach, rhubarb, Swiss chard, they're high oxalate food. They're also high calcium foods. So you may look at it and say, wow, I'm getting so much calcium because I'm getting it from spinach. But the normal person who doesn't have an oxalate sensitivity is not going to get that calcium in because it's just going to get excreted and pooped out. The person who has an oxalate sensitivity is going to have a reaction to that food, right? So there are ways around it. In a person who really likes spinach and really is growing spinach and wants to eat it, is to take extra calcium and magnesium with it, right? Calcium citrate, magnesium citrate. So you're taking extra so the oxalate and the spinach can bind it out. But if you have a systemic issue with oxalates, they're going to pass through into the system, and you have a leaky gut combination, get into the system, and then what happens? Those crystals float around. And then you can end up with kidney stones. You can end up with vulvodynia, which is one of the most common problems, vulvar pain, that people just, they can't explain it. They're just doubled over in pain. A lot of times it's oxalate sensitivity. So they're crystals. They can deposit in the joints and cause joint pain. Okay? So all of these things, burning in the bladder, they think they have a bladder infection all the time. But it's oxalate sensitivity. So you're going to be accumulating these, like the symptoms as you talk to people and you do symptom surveys or you ask questions, and you're going to figure out, well, where do we need to make changes in this person's diet. Which of these foods do we have to temporarily avoid? And you can start with one group. And then there's a list of high oxalate foods. So you have that as a chart, but you can go online. This is just a summary. You can go online and you can go anywhere and put in high oxalates, low oxalate food chart, and you're going to get them. There's a lot of differences and variations, but it gives you a starting point. And it's not, you can't avoid oxalates altogether. Who thinks you can avoid them? You can't. They're in every food. It's how much, right? So spinach might have 500 and one kind of kale might have 50 and another kind of kale might have 5, right? So it's a difference in the amount of oxalates that they have. And so it's the cumulative amount over the day. So somebody can overeat on low oxalate foods and just load up on all these low oxalate foods and exceed their oxalate threshold. But again, it's a temporary, but it's not quite as temporary as FODMAPs usually. It usually takes a while to heal and to get over this. But temporary Band-Aid, you give them some extra calcium, magnesium, so that it pulls a lot of it out in the stool. Oops. Okay, who's heard of phenols? Yeah? So phenols are, there's actually polyphenols, there's good phenols, polyphenols in wine and grapes, right? They're very protective. And it's a family of compounds that are associated with bodily function. So I'm going to show you a list of things, and you're going to see some dopamine and estrogen and other body chemicals. They're important, but it's, again, when the body's threshold is exceeded that they become a problem. So how do you know if somebody needs to be avoiding phenols? Well, we're going to look at what categories there are of phenols and what things contain it and what symptoms. So there are subcategories of phenols, amines, salicylates, and glutamine. We probably heard of salicylates in regard to the Feinberg diet. Who's heard of that? With hyperactive kids, the Feingold diet. Anybody? Yeah? It's old, right? It's been around for a while. It's low in salicylates. So maybe both. So glutamate and salicylates are both, but salicylate for sure. Might be both. Oh, it's driving me nuts. So there's some examples of phenols. Recognized any good bodily functions like dopamine, histamine, tyrosine, serotonin. So you can't get rid of them. They're not bad guys, right? That's what I'm trying to say. We're trying to demonize food. They're not bad guys. Make sense? So here's some high phenol foods. Well, they're perfectly good foods like berries and onions and grapes and all these things, parsley. I mean, these are good foods. So what I have a problem with is when people come in and they've been told to stay away from all these good foods, and now they're eating lots and lots of, I don't know, processed crap that doesn't fit into this. A lot of oils, a lot of animal products, because they're low in these things. And then they end up with too much fat, not enough antioxidant-rich foods. They're missing out on all the nutrients in these green leafy vegetables and the fruits. And we create nutrient imbalances. So if you've ever noticed that the more people get away from certain foods, the worse they feel. Have you ever had that situation? Where I just keep eliminating more, and then I eliminate more, and then I eliminate more. Steph Jackson, she might tell that story later when she talks, but she talks about a time where all she could eat was winter squash or pumpkin. That was it. Everything else made her sick. So what did she do? She just ate pumpkin for several weeks while she healed her gut and while she worked on her microbiome and while she got herself better. And she had serious autoimmune conditions, which she was able to reverse, right? And now she teaches other people how to do it. So yeah, sometimes temporarily they have to. And like Tom said before, like, I don't like the taste of this. So what? Do you like your life? Right? There's sometimes when people say, well, I can't imagine life without chocolate. I said, okay, you won't have to. Right? And it's chocolate's not a good example, but whatever it is, they're burgers and they're fries. I can't imagine life without it. Don't worry, you're not going to have to worry about that for too much longer. What do you like better, your fries or your life? And sometimes, yeah, we have to be tactful with people, but sometimes you really do have to hit them between the eyes and say, okay, which do you want more? How much are you willing to do? And I'm looking at you two right now because you two are an example of the people who just run with it, right? I teach you something, you do it. I teach you something, you do it. You explore it, you go, oh, yeah, this is hard, but oh well. You know, I'm going to do it because it's important to me. These guys are in my Energy Recharge Inner Circle program, and they just like, they're here because they just want to know more and more. And, you know, okay, what's the next bad? Okay, good, great, you know, all right, I'll do it. And I feel better, and I've lost weight, and my hemoglobin A1C is down 5 points, and, you know, so they're willing. And a lot of it is that some of them are self-motivated like that, but a lot of it is learning those techniques, and Tony's going to really hit that on Sunday, is really learning how to communicate with them so they get it. You don't want to be mean and say, okay, stop this or you're going to die. I mean, that's not, they're going to find somebody else that's going to pat them on the back. But you also don't want to pat them on the back and say, oh, yes, it's okay if you have cocaine 3 times a week, as long as you don't have it every day. Right? I mean, seriously, that's what they're doing when they eat gluten. It's like cocaine. That's what's in there. That's why people are so addicted to it. It affects the cocaine receptors in our brain. Right? So, yeah. Oh, yeah, just have it twice a week instead of 3 times a day. And you're not, I mean, when I say it with cocaine, you get it, right? If I say to you, yeah, your child wants to smoke cigarettes and they're 5. You go, of course I'm not going to let them. My child wants to drink beer and he's 6. No, you're not going to let them. My child wants some Coke and all his friends are drinking it, so I let him. Or he wants the M&Ms that he collected at Halloween, so I let him. But you wouldn't let him take cocaine. You wouldn't let him drink alcohol. You wouldn't let him smoke cigarettes. So it's a matter of helping people to create compartmentalization of those foods. Like, these are the foods I'm never going to touch. They'll go, I can't give that up. Well, you've already, how often do you smoke pot? How often do you do cocaine? How often do you, you know, get stoned and go driving? You have rules already about the things that are dangerous in your life. Let's just help them to add more things to that muscle they already have. Like, this is real dangerous. You know that they use Coke to clean up oil spills on the floor. Do you want that stuff inside your kid's body? Right? I've gotten scoffed at when I say this, but I'd rather give my kid a glass of wine than a can of Coke. Right? First of all, they can't overdo it because they'll fall asleep before they can have too much, right? With the Coke, they're wired and they just want more, and then they want the M&Ms, and right? So let's help our clients to create rules for themselves, but also you've got to do it for yourself, right? And when we talk tomorrow about the roadmap to how do you become the best practitioner you can be, part of that is your self-care, your self-nurturing, and you being a role model for them. And we're all human, and there's hard things to do, right? That's why the why, not only the why, like getting to the root of why this is happening, but getting to your why. What is your why? Why do you do this? I do what I do, and I'm really careful about what I eat and how I live and the chemicals I'm exposed to because I like feeling how I feel right now. I like feeling like I am full of energy and I can access everything, the cells in my brains, and I can pull things up quickly and I can help you and I can motivate and inspire and I can go running. Give me a break out here. I'll go running and I'll do push-ups. I did 35 push-ups before coming up here this morning. Lunges, I do lunges. I didn't do them today, honey. You weren't there to make me do them. I didn't have a limited time in a little room, but yeah, I'm going to get back to lunges. She had me do, at our NEPT retreat, by the end of it, I was doing 200 lunges, and then at one point, I did like 450. I just went out in my neighborhood. I said, I'm just going to go down whatever it was, quarter mile, half a mile, whatever, and did it, and I heard her and said, I just did it. But then I didn't do any more after that because I hurt for 3 days. It was a little too much, but it felt good while I was doing it. But to see, we've got to make those decisions for ourselves, like what's important to us and help and learn ways to motivate them. Does that make sense? I know this is a little off track with food, but it's all about food because that's how you get them to make the choices with their food. So low phenol foods, okay? At least avocados on some list. I look at my favorite avocado. I'm like, I can't eat it if I'm on a FODMAP diet. I can't, because I try to do these diets so I experience it so that I can tell people what it's like. So I would encourage you to do that. I actually did a show a few months ago where I got on and I just said, okay, we're going to do a FODMAP-SCD combination class. And I just threw out all the foods. I had my list. I threw out all the foods. I said, okay, what can I make? And we made some great dishes. They were delicious, right? So try it yourself. That'll help you come up with recipes or ideas for people when they're needing to temporarily go on this. Because what is it that keeps people from following through? Right? It's usually, I'm bored. I miss my favorite food, right? I would miss my favorite activities if I ate my favorite foods. So I don't eat my favorite foods. Well, I have new favorite foods now, but my favorite foods were ice cream and ice cream, M&Ms, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, Cheetos, and Pringles. And I ate them a lot when I was in college. No wonder I fell apart after that. Right? Now I haven't touched them in years. I make chia Pringles, though. Do you know how to make chia Pringles? So easy. Okay, you know Pringles have that little curve to them like that? So you take chia seeds, you soak them in water. You can add some salt. Then you take them and you pour them on a dehydrator tray. and in like a quarter cup size, and they're little rounds. When they come out, they're like this, and they're Pringles. I call them Chia Pringles. I said this once at a health conference. I was at a dinner with a bunch of health practitioners, and they're talking about helping people to get off of their favorite foods into what they can. I said, oh yeah, just make Chia Pringles. You could have heard a pin drop. Everybody just looked, what? I need that recipe. Like, no, they're really easy, right? How can you make chocolate bonbons? Well, easy. We'll show you some cool stuff later, right? How can you make chocolate pudding? Okay, we'll show you how. It's not hard, right? And when you learn how to do that, even if you're not a chef and you don't really get excited about that, you can teach them, you can give them recipes, you can coordinate with other people in this room to come on and do a Facebook Live with you and show people how to cook, and you can just talk about the ingredients. I mean, there's so many ways, and people love you, and they will follow you when you do that, because you can get to them through their stomach here. Amines. Okay. So they're derivatives of ammonia. They're, amino acids, right? Amines. And they are breakdown products of amino acids. So they're not the whole amino acids, but they're breakdown products of amino acids. And one example is glutamine, and one is histamine. These are examples of things that can be damaging as well as helpful. So glutamine, we talked about for leaky gut. But in certain people with certain genetics, there's a particular genetic marker called GAD, in which case they cannot convert to GABA. So glutamate and glutamine are precursors to GABA. GABA is a calming neurotransmitter. Well, the glutamate can be converted to, glutamine can be converted to glutamate if they're deficient in that enzyme. So they don't make GABA, instead they make glutamate, which is excitatory, right? Monosodium glutamate, excitatory. So glutamine is not necessarily the best thing for everybody, but it can be very helpful for some. Now, it's also a matter of listening. They say, oh, my nutritionist put me on a leaky gut protocol, and I was taking 5,000 grams of glutamine every day, and I was like bouncing off the walls. I was so excited. I was anxious. I felt like I'm going to kill somebody. Clue, they shouldn't be on that much glutamine. Make sense? So these are the things you want to understand and know in order to be able to move through. Is everybody following? Do you know all this stuff? Should I just skip this stuff? This is good? Okay, I just don't want to lose you. So histamine, who's heard of people who react to histamines or need to be on a low histamine diet? Clear example. Okay, so there's some of the high amine foods. You have your lists. So histamine, okay? Histamine we need in our body. Histamine is not evil. We have antihistamine drugs. We have a low histamine diet. We might be thinking histamine is the next gluten. Not good. No, that's not true. Okay? Histamine is actually what we need to break down in toxins, to break down inflammation. So basically histamine, if you think about your cell walls, there's histamine receptors in there. So you have an antibody come in. You have something that your body's either allergic to or it's dangerous. Streptococcus, gluten, mold, grass, something comes in. We need the histamines to break that down and open it, and they release these chemicals to kill off this stuff. But if we're creating histamines willy-nilly, right, or we can't break them down after they're produced, there's an enzyme called DAO, diamine oxide, that breaks down these histamines. And if we can't break down the histamines, they stay there. So somebody says, well, whenever I eat, my cheeks get red. I get a rash from eating certain foods. Think histamines, right? Explore the concept of histamines. And what do? Do you just take them away from histamine, high histamine foods permanently? Well, you do temporarily, and then you have to work on healing. What's causing? Why are they sensitive to histamines, right? So anytime somebody says, I get red, I get itchy, I get an itchy tongue or an itchy throat after I eat certain foods, think histamine and explore that pathway. Again, I'm trying to shorten these presentations down. We have like hour-long presentations on each of these in our program, but I'm trying to give you a sense of it so you can go, and I'm going to show you a chart that we created for you that you're going to love. So here's some high histamine foods. So the people get hives from eating strawberries, right? Pineapple, banana, walnuts, hazelnuts. There's all kinds of foods, wines for sure. Probiotic foods, sauerkraut. You ever have people who say, I feel worse after I can't eat sauerkraut? They could be sensitive to histamines, not necessarily. But you're playing detective. You're asking them questions about what they eat, what their reactions are, and you need to be keeping food diaries. Understand how important that is? Because they may not see the pattern because they don't know about all these constituents. But you're looking for patterns. Look, it looks like whenever they eat these sets of foods, what do these sets of foods have in common? Are they high histamine? Are they high phenol? Salicylates. So salicylates, do you ever hear of acetylsalicylic acid? Anybody know what that is? Aspirin, okay? So salicylates are also chemicals. They are in the phenol category, and they're made by plants, and some people are just sensitive to them. Now, there may be a genetic sensitivity. There may be an environmental. They may have damage to the gut wall. They may have some problems with their receptors. So we want to lower the salicylate levels when people are sensitive to them. What we find is it affects the brain a lot. So kids with ADD, Feingold diet, kids with ADD, very sensitive to salicylates. And it's a weird list of foods. So it's foods that may seemingly be innocent, like almonds. Like, why would this person have a problem with almonds? Well, they're high in salicylates. Okay, so when you have these lists, oh man. When you have your list around, you can start to look at their food diaries and make sense of it. You know what I mean? So if you just say, oh, they say, I have this rash and I have this and that and the other thing, that's not enough. The why comes in to find out why and how often do they have it and what are the symptoms. The symptoms are telling, but also the proximity to the foods are going to be telling. Okay, there's where my avocado comes on a lot of these lists, and I love avocado. So, but avocados are high salicylates. So if somebody says to you, I'm allergic to avocado, rarely are people going to be allergic to a food that's mostly fat. It's probably not an allergy. It could be a salicylate issue. It could be a FODMAP issue. They don't tolerate it. So I really want you to use the right language in talking about food allergies and food intolerances and food sensitivities. And that's mainly because we want to be taken seriously. And if you're talking to an immunologist and you say, oh, this person has an allergy to vitamin B12, they're going to walk away from you, right? And there are a lot of people running around with that saying, oh, my chiropractor did a desensitization to me for I was allergic to vitamin B12. Vitamin B12 isn't a protein. We're allergic. Allergic means that you're responding to the protein in the food. That's what the immune system does. It creates antibodies against a protein. It doesn't create antibodies against a certain chemical constituent like a vitamin or a mineral or a fat. So when somebody tends to be sensitive to a lot of high-fat foods, I'm more thinking, what's going on with their liver? What's going on with their gallbladder? Is their pancreas producing enough lipase to break them down? As opposed to an allergy. So people use that term, and it's innocent enough, and I sometimes use it interchangeably myself. But if we want to, you know, have yourself be taken seriously when you're talking to somebody, it's a sensitivity to a certain food, right? Or an intolerance of a certain food. And an intolerance could be because it's an allergic reaction, but it can also be because any one of these categories, and usually it's like going deep in asking why, right? So we can't just take somebody off of foods and tell them to come back in 3 weeks and see how they are. We want to work on all the underlying causes, including the stress. Because what does cortisol do? Who knows what cortisol does to the digestive tract? Anybody? Shuts it down. Because if you're digesting food when you're running away from a tiger, you're lunch, right? Okay. So there's herbs that are high in salicylates as well. So some people say, oh, I'm allergic to milk thistle or I'm allergic to this or that. Well, milk thistle is high sulfur. So people who don't break down sulfur properly, they're going to be sensitive to it. But here's some meadowsweet. And meadowsweet is actually in Metula tea. So I've had people, which is used for H. pylori. So I've had people who have a problem with H. pylori. We document it. We go, oh, try this. And they go, oh, I'm so much worse. I get all. Okay, they may have a salicylate issue as well. So it's really, you become this detective, but also you have to be juggling around with the foods. Like, oh, they're sensitive to this. How can I get a therapeutic effect in a similar way? How am I going to get this body system to respond the way I want it to? Okay, willow, white willow. So well, obviously that one, white willow, is where the aspirin, acetylsalicylic acid, is derived from, right? Birch, wintergreen. So if you find that, you know, you use wintergreen for muscle stuff and it's getting in the system and they don't tolerate it, or chewing wintergreen gum, which I don't know if it's really got wintergreen in it, but it's fake wintergreen flavor probably, right? Black cohosh. So you have somebody who develops symptoms from, you're trying to help them with, say, hot flashes, right? And you give them black cohosh and they have a bad reaction. They have one of these other reactions. So it's really a matter of like really working with people on a close level and asking lots of questions and staying with them and not just giving them a protocol and walking away. And what are some of the others? Black cohosh, we have, I think we covered them all. Black haw, that's another one for, and cramp bark, both of them are used for menstrual cramps. So they work really well, but if you give them to that person and they suddenly have, they start to say, well, I'm space cadet now and I can't remember where my keys are, you'll know that they probably have a salicylate and you ask them other questions. So that means, again, they're breakdown products. I think we talked about this before. I don't know why this is in here twice. I think I forgot to move it. High amine foods, we looked at those before. Let's look at glutamate. Okay, so glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter. Monosodium glutamate, MSG, is a food additive, and when people have that and they're sensitive to it, they can get headaches, migraines, they can get spaciness, they can have visual changes, there's all sorts of things, right? So we want to make sure that if the person is sensitive to this, or they have, if you do genetic, who does genetic testing here? Who has ever done genetic testing? Some of you guys do. If you're looking for that GAD SNP, and we'll talk more about SNPs tomorrow, so you'll get to see what that is, then that person, you got to be really careful with putting them on a leaky gut program that has glutamine in it. It doesn't mean you can't do it. It means that you work slowly. For so many of these, it's not a matter of not being able to eat the food or not being able to take the supplement, but it's an issue of how much. Does that make sense? It's not a matter of nothing, it's how much. Is there any way to adjust this? It's like my mouse keyboard is, I can adjust it. I just do a real quick, there we go. So here's some high glutamate foods. Well, surprise, MSG. But anything that says yeast, you know, autolyzed yeast. It may just say yeast. It may be soy sauce. It may say natural flavor, and that's monosodium glutamate. It may say soy protein isolate, and that's got glutamates in it. So these high glutamate foods, they're really strict with kids with autism. We're finding that when you get kids with autism off of the high glutamate foods, a lot of things happen. But a lot of them stop there. Just get them off the foods. Almost every kid with autism has leaky gut. Right? They have gluten sensitivity, so you've got to go beyond, but it's very common to get kids who have autism off of the high glutamate foods. Parmesan cheese, sauerkraut, one of the good foods, right? We try to do that. So not all good foods. It's when good foods are bad for you, when you have a glutamate sensitivity or a histamine sensitivity, and they say, oh, sauerkraut, I can't eat that, right? Going back to, I was curious for a while, I had people say whenever they ate chia seeds, they got, you know, bloated and gassy, and oh, they're high in FODMAPs. So that means that they've got some out of balance gut bacteria, and once we get that in balance, but you're going to take them off the chia seeds for a while. So a lot of people will, they'll hear me speak, they'll read, and they go, well, I'm doing that whatever food it is that you recommended, but I feel bad, but I'm going to keep doing it, and I'm doing it anyway because I know you said it's good for me. Like, no, no. I mean, there's detox symptoms that are temporary when somebody is on a detox program and they suddenly, like, they start to get achy or headachy for a few days or a few hours and then they feel better. That's a cleansing reaction. That's a good reaction if you don't exceed it, if it's not so terrible. But when it goes on and on and on, people say, oh, I'm on this diet and I'm still detoxing. Oh, yeah, how long have you been on? Oh, about 4 months. Like, no. Like, if you go on a diet and you feel bad for 4 months, that diet isn't working for you. And that's where we come in and do cleanup a lot with that, because they've read this book and that book and the other book, and they're trying to follow the protocols like what? Religion, right? As if it's their religion and they know that if they don't follow it to a T, they're going to die and go to hell or whatever, right? So they follow it like a religion, and that's when it becomes cultism, because it's dangerous. Right? We're here to change that for people. There, I did it. So there's a relationship between the sulfites and the oxalates and the phenols. So when people have low sulfate levels, it can cause a reaction to the phenols. Right? So people, so sulfur is this pathway. I'm going to show it to you tomorrow. I think I'll pass on going through the whole process because there's a pathway for body handling sulfur that's very important in the detox methylation pathway and also in the liver with glutathione. And people think, I'm just going to take glutathione. Who's ever taken glutathione, by the way? Glutathione is a great antioxidant. But when you take too much of it, your pathway gets stopped and you can go into these other pathways with the sulfur groups that cause the creation of sulfites and sulfates. And they can cause a problem. So it's never an issue of if this much is good, more is better. It's all a matter of finding the body. And if there's something that you're giving somebody as a substance to take, like a supplement, and they have, you give them too much, it turns the body's own production off. So for example, people who are on thyroid medication, right? They are diagnosed with a thyroid problem. Nobody asks why. They just say it's a Synthroid problem. They give them Synthroid. They don't know that it's a problem with the thyroid making T4. They only know that what's happening is the TSH is high and the T4 is low. We don't know why. Just give it to them and stop. And a lot of people, when that happens, is it suppresses their pituitary gland. And the pituitary makes TSH, which stimulates the thyroid to make T4. If you suppress it and you're on this medication, what happens if you stop? You don't make enough, right? Same thing with like DHEA. A lot of people will give DHEA, which I've done myself plenty of times. DHEA when somebody has adrenal dysfunction and their DHEA is really low. But if I give too much, if I give 50 milligrams of DHEA, like a lot of people are taking, that's not a physiologic dose. That's a pharmacologic dose. And what happens is the body goes, oh, I don't need to make that anymore. And it turns it off. So when we're giving supplements or bioidenticals, people ask me all the time, what do you think of bioidenticals? I think they're great in the right situation and the right amount. But if you give somebody 50 milligrams of DHEA and turn off their DHEA production, they're going to get worse. They're going to cause the gland to atrophy, their ability to make it. So I give tiny little doses multiple times a day so that people can build it up. Then you have to look at, guess what, the big question of the day. Why is their DHEA low? We're going to talk tomorrow about some of the pathways and aromatase enzymes and how the body is supposed to be converting testosterone to DHEA, and maybe it's converting it to estrogen instead. So we'll look at that tomorrow. So there's all these reasons to ask why, and also understanding how the body works, how the physiology, the biochemistry works. Make sense? Okay. So I want everybody, I see like it's the after lunch slump. So I want everybody to stand up. Okay, and you're gonna move, whatever feels good. Move around, stretch. Open up your brain, get it cleared. Tip side to side. It's tough after lunch. So I don't know if you're bored and you know all this already, or you're just tired after eating. You're bored and you wanna skip it? No, it's good? Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to read and I'm going. Okay, so one last thing and just go, yes!
Yes!
Good, get those lungs working too. Okay, sit down. Okay. All right, you're back, good. Okay, so what's the problem with sulfur? Had some notes written here I want to make sure I mentioned. Okay. So we need the sulfur to break down phenols. Does everybody know what ATP is? ATP, energy currency of the cell. If we don't make enough ATP, we don't have enough sulfur, right? So we have low cellular energy. That's going to affect everything. People say, I have plenty of energy. But what's your cellular energy like, right? Sometimes the external energy is adrenaline just kicking in. We have to have energy at the cellular level, which means we have to have all the nutrients intact. So your average client who comes in and is maybe eating a processed or semi-processed diet, they tend to get more sophisticated people, so they're eating a semi-processed diet. And they're getting a lot of processed foods without their B vitamins, without the magnesium, without the nutrients they need. Their mitochondria can't work properly. We have a whole module in there, right? You guys know that. The metabolism, B vitamins, NAD, FAD, niacin, bioflavonoids, there's amino acids that are needed, there's thiamine, all of these things are needed. We're not getting it in the food we don't process right. If we don't have good cellular metabolism, then we are not going to be able to flush toxins out, bring nutrients in, and those cells are not going to be able to work properly. Okay? So with sulfur, it requires good ATP to make the sulfate. The other things are two things that Dr. O'Brien talked about earlier, right? H. pylori and digestive gut imbalance, right? So if we have digestive imbalance, we can have sulfur problems. So some people, you know, they eat dried fruit. The olden days of dried fruit, the like really pretty looking dried fruit, it's loaded with sulfites, which interferes with your sulfur metabolism, which causes symptoms in a lot of folks. Right. So sulfur is an important piece. Now, here's the thing. People go, I'm going on a low sulfur diet. And what do they eliminate? Anybody call out some of the foods that are high in sulfur? Broccoli, all the brassicas. Onions, garlic, okay? Brussels sprouts, cabbage, kale, all of these good foods. So you're missing all the nutrients from that instead of working on why are you having problem with the sulfite. Healing the gut, right? Getting rid of the H. pylori if it's there and moving it out. But yes, you need a low sulfur diet for a while. A lot of people for a while, now they're getting away from it when they were reading genetics. There's particular genetic SNPs called CBS. And that was a big thing. I think it was started by Amy Yasko. And she would say, oh, well, if you have high, if you have a CBS SNP, cystathionine, blah, 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 it's a big long word, then you cannot process the sulfur properly. You got to stay away from the high sulfur foods. And I know people who just did that and felt miserable after 2 weeks, right? Because they went to the extreme. So you have to be the voice of sanity for your clients. You have to be the one who is there for them to say, look, you can't follow every fad diet out there. If you do, there's nothing left to eat. And you know what happens when they follow these diets really strictly? What happens after 2 weeks on one of these strict diets? Binge, right? Yeah. It's like, oh, I haven't had it for weeks, I'm going to go. And then they come and tell you they've been on a low whatever diet for 2 years. Like, well, yeah, 2 weeks at a time. Every 2 weeks I alternate back off of it. You got to be able to design a diet for them that works with their busy schedule, that addresses their food likes. And you can do substitutions. I have a really cool chart you're going to get in a bit with food swaps. Okay? Sources of sulfate, well, certainly the dried fruits, the whitening gums, preservatives, ingredients. Let's see what else. I'm not going to read this whole thing. See if there's anything I really specifically want to say. No. Vanilla, right? So you got to watch for what they're responding to so you can help them to categorize. Got it? Okay. I'm sorry, vehicle. It was all the way at the bottom. I didn't read. I'm like, vanilla extract. So these are, I think I need the break. Okay. So this is a critical one. This is one I want you to pay attention to because you're going to see people with multiples. You're going to see people with symptoms that overlap, right? So if they're having behavior issues, you want to make sure you look at as possible sensitivities, the salicylates, amines, and the glutamates, right? If they also have mood and body pain, mood problems with body pain, you want to also look at oxalates because the crystals, right, the oxalate crystals will develop there. Physical symptoms like the dark circles under their eyes, the cheeks, the diarrhea. You want to add all the rest, but polysaccharides, so the specific carbohydrate or GAPS diet. When they have the digestive pain, specific carbohydrate and FODMAPs also. Any metabolic problems. I had a person that every time she had anything with even the tiniest bit of oxalate in it, she couldn't function at all. I mean, it wasn't like she specifically got gut pain or kidney pain or joint pain. She just went completely, like her brain went offline. And she got exhausted and she couldn't deal with it. extreme oxalate. And it took her a while to figure that out, right? We're digging and going, what is this cause? But everything, and everything, even a tiny bit, it wasn't like spinach. And I remember after I'd been working with her for a while, and we're working on her gut, and she goes, I ate 2 leaves of spinach today. And most people would say, okay. But for her to eat 2 whole leaves of spinach was a miracle for her, right? Because all her favorite food, she loved green leafy vegetables. She loved all these spices. Turmeric, I mean, we were talking earlier, just to say that not to play devil's advocate or anything, but I'll play devil's advocate. I love turmeric. I think turmeric's great. But you can't say that turmeric is good for everybody and everybody should eat it every day. And if they don't tolerate it, then you got to look for why. And it is high in oxalate, right? And maybe not the tiny bit that somebody might have in their Indian food twice a month. But if you're eating it therapeutically every single day and you're eating large amounts of it, like a teaspoon in a smoothie or the concentrated curcumin extract, that the person, it could aggravate an oxalate sensitivity. So just keep these things in mind. It's always in the clues or in the history when they tell you, oh, ever since I started that really healthy diet you put me on, I'm having these symptoms. Okay, you got to go with, what did you add to your diet that you weren't having before? And what did you increase the amount of that you weren't? Maybe they have a nightshade sensitivity, but they hardly ever ate tomatoes because they live in a cold climate. They only ate them in the summer for a little while. And they read about like all these great benefits. And maybe it's a guy who read about tomatoes are great for prostate. And they start loading on the tomato sauce and eating tomatoes. And now their joints are hurting, right? Or they're having urinary burning, right? So it's really like, I can't emphasize this enough. I want you to understand enough about how these things go to ask the questions. Why is the big question? When is a great question? Who, why, what, when, where, right? All of those questions are great to dig into. When do these symptoms happen? When did they start happening? And what are they related to? All right. So almost there. It's the question of, so, okay, that's what I just talked about. Always. Why? Whenever they have problems and you're looking for why they're having it, is there a problem with sulfation, which is a liver phase 2 process? Is there a problem with methylation, right? A lot of people have genetic, 40% of the population has an MTHFR SNP. Does anybody know what everybody's heard of MTHFR, right? 40% of the population has that. That's huge. That's not just like a small group of people. That's huge. So when it's looking at that, why? Here's what I think, because I always ask that, why? If I believe that SNP developed, like that gene, that's always been that way. Like that we're not intended to need such strong detox pathways, right? We just need a little bit to handle the internal toxins. And that now we're seeing the problems related to it. I just think like, you have blue eyes, I have brown eyes. If I were to say that blue eyes are the normal and everybody with brown eyes has a defect, you'd go, huh? So it's same thing in the body. These may not be defects, they're just differences between you and I, like hair color, like eye color, strength of the liver, strength of whatever, but we shouldn't need it. We only have problems with it if we have an environment that exposes it. I have double MTHFR, I have 2 MTHFR SNPs. That's rare. I see it a lot, but it's not like the norm. And you would think that I would be chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia and all kinds of problems, and I'm not. Because I decided 25 years ago, before the Genome Project even happened, that I said, I must have bad genes. Because there's no old people in my family. And they die of heart attacks or diabetes or whatever. I don't have old people in my family. I have an uncle I just got to see a couple of weeks ago, and he's my oldest living relative. Guess how old he is? You're close, 71. He's my oldest living relative, huh? My parents would have been 80 and 85 and 80 or something like that. My mom died at 56. My dad died at 62, okay? Within 2 years of each other, right? So genetically, but also they had bad habits, right? So I decided I can't afford to have bad habits. Before the Genome Project, before I measured it, I just looked at my family and I said, I want to live to be old. You know, I want to be vibrant. And my mom died at 56 and I already had considered her an old person. I look back and go, holy cow, she was 56. Like, she wouldn't be doing the things I'm doing. When I was 56, I was doing crazy stuff. I'm still doing crazy stuff. So when I passed my mother in age, it was like, wow, this is great, but I want to keep going, right? I don't want it to stop there. And I wouldn't consider myself old by any stretch. I'll probably be 80 and I won't consider myself old because I'm going to keep active and I'm going to keep taking care of myself. And sure, I could get run over by a bus anytime, right? We don't know. We can't predict. But I think that when we can treat, act as if we have bad genes. If you're not going to go testing, tell people, act as if you have bad genes. So I look at it, and I look at some of the people I've worked with who have worse symptoms than I. They have better genes. So I know that there's power in epigenetic modification. I know it. I feel like I'm living it. When I went this summer to my niece's wedding, and we had this wedding in the Bahamas, not the Bahamas, but somewhere out there in the Caribbean. And when I got there, my sister-in-law, who's like 11 years younger than me, she looked at me and she said, I hadn't seen her in a long time. She said, you do look like your picture. I thought you had all this touch-up done. How do you have a waist like that? How old are you? You're the youngest of these sisters. I said, no, I'm the oldest. You're older than them? And she was pointing to my sisters who were standing right there. I said, yeah, I'm older than them. That's correct. And she says to my brother, who's her husband, she says, did you know that Rita Marie's the oldest? I'm like, damn, he's my brother, you know? He's my brother. He knows I'm the oldest. But she was just in awe. She couldn't understand why I looked so different than the rest of them, why my body structure, my strength, my energy, you know, my skin, everything. And I'm not, you know, bragging or anything. I'm just saying it's possible that you don't have to age gracelessly. You can age gracefully, right? And it's how we take care of ourselves. So you start with you taking care of you and making that commitment to you. And then you move on and you're like the thing. People say to me, what do you want for your health? I'll say, what's your biggest dream? And he goes, I'm going to be like you when I grow up. Like, okay. But we can live it. And then they're inspired to do it. What are you doing? How are you doing this? Right? My uncle, when he turned 50, the one that's 71 now, he was complaining about his aches and his pains and he was old. He goes, Rita Marie, just wait. Just wait till you're 50. I'm like, really? I'm not going there. 50, I did a marathon, my first one. So why? What is it? Is it their immune system? Is it their digestion? Is it their adrenals? Is it their kidneys? Is it the crap they're eating for breakfast? Are they eating carbs but at the wrong time of day for their body to tolerate it, right? And maybe they're eating good food, but they're eating it at the wrong time of day. Those of you in IRSPT, you know, we talk about that. The timing is so important, right? If you have carbs in the morning, you're going to throw off your leptin, and it's not going to work well. Your blood sugar's up and down, but if you have your carbs later in the day, it's going to work much better. So it's finding it for the person and not going into dogma. So for me, I was teaching, and I do still teach it in insulin resistance, that we should be having a breakfast within an hour of waking up and have protein. Now, I'm dealing with a specific population. And that works really well because, you know, it puts you into adrenal dysregulation and the alarm and all that if you don't. And it also affects the blood sugar. But I discovered that for me and a lot of other people, once we've gotten the basics there, I do better without food in the morning. I do better if I wait till noon or later to eat my first meal. So that's what I do most of the time, right? And that's what some people do. Intermittent fasting, I don't like calling it that. I like calling something else intermittent fasting. We'll talk about that a little bit tomorrow. Does that make sense? But you're working with people, individuals, and of course I'm going to give you some protocol type things, but they're not casting concrete. All right, so lectins, there's this whole thing, everybody's coming to me, what about the plant paradox? And what about the plant paradox? You're telling us to eat chia seeds and you're telling us to eat all these foods and this guy's saying they're not good. And there are people who are sensitive, and they're not processing them, and they have leaky gut, and they can't handle it. And yes, a low lectin diet can be amazing for people. As what? A permanent or temporary? Temporary. There's so much good stuff. These foods that have lectins, they're just protective things in the plant to keep the predators away. But we should be able to tolerate them in those amounts. It could be that we're eating too much, like grains. People are eating way too much grain, right? It could be that they're eating them in the wrong way, like they're not soaking their legumes before they eat them, and they're still having a lot of those inhibitors in there, and the lectins are still in there. So there's ways to decrease the lectin content. So They're basically the benefit. They have benefits, okay? The lectins can actually decrease certain disease states. I mean, there actually can be protective lectins. So why do we just throw out the whole thing and say, oh, these foods are bad? And the book is, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in this lectin book, right? But it's, again, creating a religion and creating fear with people. There was a really good video. You could see it on YouTube. Joel Kahn, he was a cardiologist, an integrative cardiologist, went up against him and said, look at the blue zones. They eat foods that have lectins, but what? They only eat the whole stuff. They don't make it three quarters of their diet like Americans do. And he went on, and he quoted specific chemical constituents and all this. So if you want to look it up, look up lectins on YouTube, lectins and Joel Kahn, and it'll probably come up. It was an excellent explanation of why don't just jump on this low lectin bandwagon. We're looking for answers, right? Everybody's looking for the magic bullet. So they look for the magic bullet. If they're oriented away from Western medicine, they look for the magic bullet in the magic diet, right? What's the latest and the greatest magic diet? And there is none, right? Yes, and this is what I want you to be aware of. Yes, if people are coming in and they're bloated and they're gassy and they have low energy and they have joint pains, you will look at this. And low lectin, actually, it's close to a paleo diet in some sense, but they're also eliminating a lot of the nuts and seeds because they say the seed coatings. Well, if you sprout them, you germinate them, you're going to remove most of the lectins, right? If you ferment them, you're going to remove most of the lectins, and you're not going to have a problem. If we look at traditional peoples, they eat foods in different ways than they do. They don't buy cans of beans and open them up and pour them on their salad. That's not how they eat beans, right? They'll soak them and a lot of them put sea vegetables in there, which break down some of the lectins, and they break it up. It's like this adhesion factor. They're sticky, right? So there's ways to make the foods and still have those foods in the diet. Now, some people don't tolerate. I don't do that well. I don't do much in the way of beans and grains, not because of lectins, but because, and I know it's not because of lectins because I do great on nuts and seeds, which have them, but it's because of the sugar elevating effects, right? And I haven't tested them recently, I will admit, but I have like 47 genes for insulin resistance, and I grew up on Kool-Aid. So I have sort of sugar sensitivities, and I'm still working on it, so I don't even bother trying any of those things. I just stick to lots of vegetables and a little bit of quinoa sometimes and that. But you're asking questions. That's how you're going to get at this, right? You're going to ask questions, and if they've tried other things, you can try the low-lectin diet for a while. Try a diet for 30 days with people and see how they do. Nightshades, right? People say, oh, but I'm going to eliminate all that. Should I also eliminate nightshades? Well, maybe, right? Do you have joint pains? That's usually what nightshades are associated with. Lots of other things too. But you definitely want to give it a try, especially if they've, like, I'm first for foundations, get them on the whole foods and get rid of the crap. And now they're still having problems. Let's try eliminating this for a little bit and see if there's some improvement. Is this all making sense? All right. So here's some food sources. All foods contain lectins, right? They're especially high in legumes, especially raw legumes and grains. Most people don't eat raw legumes and grains. But if you're into sprouting, you go, oh, sprouted lentils, sprouted whatever. Don't do kidney beans. They're the worst. They really are dangerous if you just try to eat raw kidney beans, okay? So that's, and some people are more sensitive than others due to autoimmune or leaky gut. Okay, so generally when people are sensitive to the lectins, they also have an autoimmune condition. Make sense? That's the name of the chemical. I'm not going to even try to say it. Anybody want to try say it? Phytohemagglutinin. Okay, that's a lectin found in those red kidney beans, and it's very potent, very, very potent. Okay, so it has, you know, between 30,000 and 70,000 lectin units compared to 200 to 300 in the fully cooked, right? So if you can eat kidney beans, eat them cooked, right? All right. I think I talked about that. So this is the plant paradox, forbidden foods. If you've got the book, you know, you recognize this. These are the forbidden foods. So while there's a lot of good foods on there, so if you're trying to be plant-based and you're going low lectin, it's hard, right? Because most of the good solid foods, the beans, the grains, the nuts and seeds are going to be high in lectins. But you may have to do it for a while, right? There's things like oils, and there's certain plants that aren't. There's certain ones, and you can try it for a while. But I just, the reason I've gotten a little bit irritated with this book and this trend is because of the dogma and the religion about it, right? There's definitely something to it, but it's not like everybody has to do it. And he promotes it, and then they have also the products, and, you know, they're not such good Whole Foods products, all of them. Okay. So that's how you reduce it. We talked about that already. Sprouting, fermenting, soaking, and then cooking, and adding sea vegetables. All of those things will help reduce the lectins. So if you feel like, wow, this lectin thing may be a problem, before you dump all the lectins, try some of these food processing issues, right? Doing these things to the foods. And if you still have problems, eliminate them for a while. And then when you add them back in, you do it in the sprouted form, the fermented form. Okay? Make sense? Okay. So this is what I'm excited about. And can you guys pass this out? So we created this chart. We're only giving you page one today because it's taken like forever. So all of these food things we've talked about are across the top. Now, all the foods we could think about, even some weird ones I never heard of. I said, Lynn, what is that? She goes, oh, it's a fish. Oh, I don't ever heard of it. Okay, we'll leave it there. So we've researched all these foods to see which they go in. So if it's green, obviously it's allowed on that food thing. I think I lied because, what is that? Anchovies? There we go. Anchovies. They are good for all of them. That's the only food that we've found so far that has green all the way across, okay? So when people say, well, if I follow all these things, what am I going to eat? You say anchovies. That's it. Right? They're little. You can carry them in a can, right? I don't eat anchovies. But so if it's green, it means it's allowed on that particular diet. Don't hold us to this. We're going to go back and double check because, you know, sometimes you get blurry-eyed when you're doing this and you put the little color in the wrong box. This is a 7-page chart. When you get it uploaded to the site, which hopefully will be, you know, relatively soon, we can put it up what we have there now. Well, we'll put it up what we have there now. It'll have a lot of white still in there. But when we finally do it, it'll be completed, and we're going to give you the alphabetical list of all the foods, so you can find any food easily. But then we're going to do it by group. So that last column where it has that little letter, which category it fits in, V for vegetable, L for legume, B for beverage, that all of those, we're going to sort the list by that and we'll format it so you'll see, okay, here are all the vegetables, here are all the fruits, here are all the others. So if people are eliminating particular groups, you can just leave them out and not do it. All right? Like it? This was our gift to you. Holy cow. Lynn, let's give Lynn a hand. This is what I was working on last night at the restaurant when Debbie Bart said to me, where's your flux? Where's Debbie? So I wanted at least to get it to the point where most of it, I still can't, some of them we can't find. Like you can't find a definitive either way. Yellow means be cautious with it. Like a lot of the things in the glycemic column, I put all the grains and all the fruits in the caution, the yellow, because for some people, they need to just test their blood sugar and see. And for some people, quinoa is fine, for other people not. Why is everybody leaving? All right, you're going to miss it. The goals of the healing diet is to get rid of the foods that hurt, make abundance of the foods that heal. And it's going to be different from person to person. This looks like a great picture, but somebody might be sensitive to mushrooms, right? Somebody else may be sensitive to coconut. And make friends with plants, because we really need a lot of plants in the diet. Remember the whole, the microbiome gets fed, how the butyrate gets created from those. We got to make friends with plants, and these are some of my, whoops, that was fast. These are some of my favorite plants. Okay, leave the allergens behind. I always start people on an elimination diet of the top common ones because they don't know if they're sensitive to it until they take it out and put it back. And then you create a list of the ones based on the symptoms of any of the others you want to leave out. And you put them on an elimination diet and then you add them back in. Okay, food swap list. Pass that one out. Where is everybody? Okay, so we're going to give you a copy of this. And this was another act of love that we did back in the spring. Between Lynn and I think Tony might have gotten involved with that one. So it's a food swap list, and it's basically for the things. Tony has this concept of good, better, best, right? So you may think that the best thing is for them to make everything homemade and perfect and all this, and they're so busy that they're going, forget it, I'm just going to McDonald's. So if you can give them a good choice, a better choice, and a best choice for the things you want them to leave out, as you go through and you figure out their intolerances or the foods that you know are not very good for them, you pull them out. So you've got a 2-page chart. And you can play with this chart. You're going to have a copy of it on the site so you can fill it in for each person. With the other chart, the food religions chart, we're going to give you PDFs of it. We'll give you two separate PDFs. We'll have it on our shared drive for NEPT folks, so we'll have access to the Google Doc and you can add your own stuff. If you see things on those charts that you want added, just write to us and let us know. We're constantly trying to improve it. Is this helpful? You like this? Last thing I want to mention, and then we're going to go to break, is snacking and grazing. Okay? So who's heard that eat every 2 hours to keep your blood sugar steady? Okay? Who believes it? Good. You guys are educated. No, do it. In addition to the problem with blood sugar, and it causes lots of insulin, which causes all the problems with excess insulin, excess weight, lack of muscle, the whole bit. You've got the problem with the microbiome, and with SIBO, you need to keep things moving through, and there's something called the migrating motor complex, and the migrating motor complex only starts to really be activated about 4 hours after you eat, 3.5 to 4 hours. So when you don't leave enough space, things don't move down a lot, and a lot of the microbes can get caught here in the small intestine instead of making their way to the large intestine. So it's really a good thing to do, and also to give your gut a rest, right, to allow it to rest. So we're going to take a break, and what time is it now? Can this have time on it as well as the countdown? What time is it? 3:30? 3:33? Oh my, we went over 3 minutes. Oh well. We'll come back in 15 minutes. We'll come back. Well, you come back. This is a short break. It's a bio break. No, is this the full break? What time is it? It's a short break. Bio break. Get yourself something to drink and get your bathroom, get yourself moving and be back here. We're not going to do a raffle because it's too short a break. So just get back here by, what time? 3? Somebody tell me. 3 o'clock? 4? 3:45. Okay? Well, it's 3:33, so we'll give you a few minutes after that. Wonderful speaker on the microbiome. Okay? Thank you.